Many of you were here when Ambassador Dean visited us earlier in the history of the Miller Center. At that time, we reminded you that he was the U.S. representative to the NATO-Warsaw Pact force reduction negotiations in Vienna, talks that went on for a considerable period. He'd been deputy U.S. representative earlier in that process. He also was deputy U.S. Negotiator of the 1971 four-power Berlin Agreement with the Soviet Union. Ambassador Dean began his career in 1950 in Bonn as the liaison officer between the U.S. High Commission and the newly established government of the German Federal Republic. In this capacity, his work included helping establish the new German armed forces. Subsequently, he was first secretary at the American Embassy in Prague, principal officer and counselor in Elizabethville, Katanga during the Shambe succession, and deputy director of the United Nations Political Affairs Office in the Department of State. In 1968, he returned to the American Embassy in Bonn as political counselor and worked on political military issues and participated in the negotiations leading up to the four-power agreement on Berlin. In 1973, he took on the assignment as MBFR negotiator in Vienna, following nearly a decade of involvement in arms control and European security issues. He joined the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace as resident associate on arms control and European security issues. And currently, he's advisor on national security and arms control issues of the Union of Concerned Scientists. His book, which we mentioned at that time, was Watershed in Europe, and subsequently he's published Meeting Gorbachev's Challenge. We had hoped very much that he could join us to discuss the presidency and nuclear initiative, and so we have looked forward to this forum for a long time, and we know that, as in previous meetings, we'll learn a great deal from Ambassador Dean.
Thank you very much. Well, good morning to you all, and I'm very pleased to be here once again in this beautiful new room and to talk about the Bush initiative on nuclear weapons and beyond. I want to make a personal apology to you before I start. I'm the arms control advisor of the Union of Concerned Scientists, as Professor Thompson has said, and we have almost all of the American Nobel Prize winners as members of our group. It's the largest association of its kind. Last year, our chairman, Henry Kendall, got the Nobel Prize for Physics. But despite all his high-priced talent, none of them have been able to help me with short-term memory loss, so I'm tied to my notes rather more than I would like to be. I hope you will excuse me for that. To our theme, it's a real paradox after more than 5 years of positive developments in the foreign relations of the Soviet Union, the foreign policy of the Soviet Union, that the greatest danger now facing our country from the Soviet Union is still the nuclear threat, although in a different form than in the past. All of us welcomed the political aftermath of the failed anti-Gorbachev coup in the Soviet Union. In a few days, all the remnants of the old system seemed swept away: the Communist Party, the KGB, the military influence, all of the old power centers crumbled. But a second look reveals a more ominous prospect, the prospect of the dissolution of command and control over the more than 25,000 nuclear weapons in the Soviet Union. And in fact, we do appear to be on the edge of nuclear anarchy in that country. President Gorbachev has not yet been able to assemble a full session of the Council of Republics to ratify the START and the CFE agreement on conventional forces. The current situation in the USSR with regard to custody over nuclear weapons, both strategic and tactical, is alarming. Some of President Yeltsin's influential advisors, who were irritated by interference from the Moscow Center, from the Soviet Union ministries with Yeltsin's economic program, are arguing that there should be no central authority whatever in the former Soviet Union, and that issues of custody over nuclear weapons, like other issues, should be settled between the Russian Federation and the other republics on a direct basis with no outside interference. General Lobov, who is the new chief of staff of the Soviet Union forces, has suggested that the problem of custody over these weapons could be solved if everyone hands over the nuclear weapons now on their soil to the Russian Republic. The Ukraine and Kazakhstan have said that they ultimately want no nuclear weapons on their territory, but they also have made quite clear that they don't want the Russian Federation to have monopoly control over these weapons, and also that they won't relinquish custody of the weapons on their territory until other aspects of their relationship with the Russian Federation are settled. The Ukraine is also saying that it wants to destroy the nuclear weapons now on its territory itself in order to cut the overall number and to avoid building up the Russian monopoly. President Kravchuk of the Ukraine said on his recent visit to Washington that he needs lots of outside advice and also outside money to carry out this destruction. The Belarusian defense minister, whose government is composed of unreconstructed communists, has justified retention of nuclear weapons there by the old argument that NATO still has nuclear weapons. Custody over nuclear weapons on the territory of the various republics is still exercised by Union armed forces, but the republics say that only their own armed forces should be stationed on their territory. The Ukrainian legislature, Kazakhstan, also has passed a law transferring to their sovereignty all military forces and assets on their territory, conventional or nuclear. Now Georgia has done the same. So we are facing the risk of immediate proliferation. Instead of one monolithic nuclear power with strict control over its nuclear weapons and a deep knowledge of their possible effects, we face the possibility of four nuclear powers, each of them unstable, and at least three of them without the knowledge of nuclear weapons, which have made the United States and the Soviet governments very cautious about circumstances which could lead to use of these weapons. And there are further proliferation risks from the post-coup Soviet Union. The Russian Federation has about 10,000 tactical nuclear weapons on its territory, but there are 5,000 more scattered on the territory of the other republics. It appears that some of the weapons pulled back from Eastern Europe, the tactical ones, have been stored in the Ukraine, but there is some question as to whether their number corresponds to the bookkeeping on this subject. There is a risk that these weapons may be taken over by terrorists for exploitation, perhaps as blackmail to involve outside powers like the United States or the European Community on their side. And we hear repeated reports of an attack by Azeri nationalists on a nuclear storage site in Baku at the beginning of 1990. Now, equally risky, perhaps even more so, is the possibility that these weapons may be sold outside the country. Now, as regards other proliferation aspects, some thousands of trained nuclear physicists, most of them low paid, and many of them already unemployed, are scattered among the Soviet republics, as are a large number of nuclear research labs and energy-producing reactors. Some republics may in time seek to develop their own nuclear weapons, but the more immediate risk is of hard currency sale of nuclear expertise and components to third world countries like Pakistan, North Korea, Libya, Iran. In 1990 and 91, the Soviet central government sold nuclear power plants to Pakistan and to India, two mutually hostile, undeclared nuclear powers, without requiring that they accept full-scope safeguards on all their nuclear plants. The majority of Soviet uranium processing plants are in the Asian republics, Kyrgyzstan and Tajikistan, far from the weakening control of Moscow, also creating a possibility of hard currency sales to third world countries like India, Pakistan, and India. The present Soviet system of controls over exports of nuclear materials is loose, and enforcement is irregular. As far as is known, the republics have neither legislation nor enforcement on this issue. Many of you have seen November 8th New York Times the description of the Chetek Corporation of Moscow, which offers services to carry out peaceful nuclear explosions on a commercial basis. This is permissible under the Non-Proliferation Treaty and the Treaty on Peaceful Nuclear Explosions, but it does illustrate the problem of loose expertise. Now, we also face the problem that there are no controls whatever on the level of nuclear arms of the other declared nuclear powers, especially China, which may undergo a devolution of power somewhat similar to the Soviet Union, with similar risks of slipping into regional control over nuclear weapons. Last Saturday, at the meeting of the American Association for Chinese Study here in Charlottesville, it appeared to be the majority view that such a devolution of power was in the offing. North Korea, Secretary Baker has recently spoken of those dangers. The dangers there and Iran are dangerous puzzles. And there are no controls whatever on the weapons of the three undeclared nuclear states, Israel, India, and Pakistan. The risk of development of nuclear weapons by non-nuclear states has increased each year with the wider availability of expertise and technical knowledge. This circumstance, as we know, enabled Iraq to engage in three different methods of developing nuclear weapons unknown to Western intelligence or to the International Atomic Energy Authority. Capabilities which, according to IAEA inspectors, could have resulted in systematic production of nuclear-armed missiles within 2 years. This problem will get still worse when Soviet nuclear expertise is on the loose. Now, considerations like these provided the main motive for President Bush's welcome nuclear arms initiative of September the 27th. And President Bush and President Gorbachev did good work in their rapid exchange of proposals in addressing the most immediate aspects of the problem, cutting back the risk of accidental launch and moving to tighten custody over warheads. We can only hope that it will actually be possible to actually carry out the offer of help which President Bush made. With regard to physical custody of tactical nuclear weapons, I would be happier, which, by the way, do not have the control devices on them which limit their use, which the strategic weapons have. I'd be happier with the idea of bringing them together in a few central storage sites under loose United States or international surveillance, even if the United States has to reciprocate with the Soviet Union. Second, as the NATO summit has just emphasized, whatever the long-term relationship among the Soviet republics may turn out to be, the Western countries have a strong security interest in central command and control and in accountability for storage of existing weapons and weapons-producing installations, by some central authority acting in collaboration with the republics. We have a parallel interest, of course, in central accountability for currency, loans, and debts. But here the agreement reached by the Group of Seven seems already to have been blocked, at least for a time, by the refusal of Azerbaijan to comply. And we have an interest in central accountability with regard to the conduct of the Soviet permanent seat in the United Nations Security Council, which is vital for future measures against proliferation and for peacekeeping. We can't object if the republics want co-decision over possible use of nuclear weapons, but there should be no mixed responsibility for command or for day-to-day control over existing weapons. This point must be made clear as an absolute condition, both for recognition and for aid. I think the United States government will do this, and I believe that the European members of the European community will also. I think let's take a more detailed look at the Bush initiative. Once again, the president has reacted promptly, as he did, to the collapse of the Warsaw Treaty and also to the German unity question and the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait. His proposals came only 5 weeks after the anti-Gorbachev coup, which is record time for initiatives of this scope in the nuclear field. And in my view, the president's initiative is highly positive in all but three respects. One is continued funding for the B-2 aircraft, where we already have other aircraft which can carry out conventional bombing missions if they're needed. Second, the proposal for a limited nationwide missile defense. I'll come back to that. And a rather ambiguous position on a desirable objective, the objective of reducing the multiple warheads, or MIRVs. Especially worthwhile elements of the president's proposal are, first, the radical decision to withdraw ground-based tactical weapons on a worldwide scale. The action to withdraw United States tactical weapons from Europe was already in the cards. And second, to destroy the warheads. Destruction is a necessary and overdue step, especially if what is involved is really destruction and not dismantling and storing the fissile material. A second component of great interest and value was the president's decision to withdraw and partially destroy tactical range nuclear arms from surface ships and submarines. The third component, which is of great value, are the proposed actions to reduce the readiness status of United States forces, including taking bombers off alert, and the proposal for cooperative measures with the Soviets to improve custody and control over nuclear weapons, their storage, transport, dismantling, and destruction. This was clearly the most urgent aspect of the president's proposals, and Gorbachev has now accepted it. But agreement here is not enough. Implementation is essential. We're now in a grim race with centrifugal forces in the USSR, which is more and more coming to resemble a super Balkans with nuclear weapons. President Bush did not mention that his proposal to withdraw MIRVs from land-based intercontinental missiles was not a new one, and in fact that it has already been rejected by the Soviets several times because it omits the multiple warheads on submarines. Gorbachev has questioned it again, his initial reaction. On a rough calculation, if the president's proposal in this regard were carried out, it would reduce only about 500 warheads from the United States post-start level of over 10,000, but it would call for a reduction of about 2,000 from the post-start Soviet level of 8,000, which would leave the United States with nearly two times as many strategic warheads as the Soviet Union. Even if it were possible to agree on an outcome this lopsided, there would still be too many warheads on both sides for real stability. In the interests of dispersal, the submarine-based warheads should also be cut back. Reducing the number of these warheads will become necessary if the overall level drops again after start. Because if the United States does not cut back on its submarine-based multiple warheads, all of its permitted weapons could end up by being on a few submarines. The President canceled research and development on the rail-based version of the MX missile, on the mobile version of the small single warhead missile now in development, and on the air-mounted short-range attack missile, including the version planned for deployment in Europe. He didn't mention the current programs for development of maneuverable warheads, called MARVs, or earth-penetrating warheads. In his October 5th response, Gorbachev agreed to President Bush's challenge of parallel unilateral actions, and he agreed to destroy all ground-based tactical nuclear weapons, Soviet weapons, to remove all tactical range weapons from surface ships and submarines, to destroy a portion of the nuclear weapons of anti-aircraft missiles, of which there are a large number in the Soviet Union, to continue to keep Soviet bombers off alert — they have not been on alert, as ours have been — to stop development of new mobile missiles — they had one at least planned — to freeze the level of rail mobile ICBMs, and to keep them in base. He didn't include the road mobile SS-25s, and to remove some ICBMs from alert. And President Gorbachev also proposed a moratorium on nuclear testing, since rejected, a negotiation on a further post-start cut of about 50% in strategic arms. This is something which the Soviet Union has been talking about for the last 2 or 3 years in connection with START II. And this appears to be his answer to the President's proposal to remove MIRVs from land-based missiles only. He also proposed destruction as well as withdrawal of all tactical naval weapons and central storage of aircraft-mounted weapons. Reversing the earlier Soviet opposition to missile defense, which has gradually been weakening over the years, he agreed to discuss the possibility of developing a system of non-nuclear defenses against missile attack, as well as creation of a joint early warning system with both space and ground-based components. The Russian Republic's warning system has collapsed because most of its components were in the surrounding republics. What is missing from the Bush initiative, and perhaps this is characteristic of this president so effective in foreign affairs, and what needs to be added now, is some concept of the long-term Western nuclear relationship with the Soviet Union and its successor states, some indication of where Western nuclear weapons policy should be headed in the long run and the steps needed to get there. This should include some idea of how far we should go in strategic reductions and the role of nuclear weapons in Europe, as well as a much more active policy of controlling proliferation. And we will have to reach decisions on the issue of missile defenses. A failure to formulate and present these long-term goals soon could mean that the Western coalition may miss the opening for a general breakthrough on nuclear weapons, going far beyond Gorbachev's response to Bush, which now exists in the Soviet Union. This opening may not last indefinitely. There is strong built-in potential in the Soviet situation, especially under the impact of increasing economic hardship and unemployment, for moves towards a nationalistic, authoritarian approach in all the republics. Moreover, inter-republic relations are not likely to be smooth. If these developments take place, the possibilities for far-reaching negotiation on nuclear arms are likely to tighten considerably. There's also a time factor with regard to China. If regional party leaders or military warlords gain control over these weapons, it will be a good deal harder to introduce an agreed regime of limits and restrictions on Chinese nuclear capability. Consequently, there is a very strong case for using the present opening to move towards eliminating for all time the potentiality for surprise attack from the Soviet Union or the republics, a potentiality created by high levels of strategic warheads, and for coming to real grips with the proliferation problem. And I would like now to summarize for you a possible program of this kind, which has been developed by Professor Gottfried of Cornell and me. It contains four main elements. The first of them is the negotiated reduction of United States and Soviet nuclear warheads of all types to the level of 1,000 or 2,000, what we're calling a reserve nuclear force, to be used only to deter nuclear attack or to respond to it if it occurs. The term stability is overused in discussing security issues, but we define nuclear stability between East and West in a fairly direct way as the absence of capability for surprise attack. And the same, of course, goes for conventional stability as provided for in the still unratified Treaty on Conventional Forces in Europe. In the nuclear weapons field, measures to reduce alert and readiness levels on both sides are essential. We too have been urging them for some time. But measures like these are not sufficient by themselves to do the job of making command and control and remaining weapons less vulnerable and capable of riding out an initial attack. To achieve this, measures like these must be combined with drastic cuts in warhead levels. As long as each side has enough warheads to have a reasonable possibility of successful surprise attack, whatever their intentions, and we estimate this level as between 2,000 and 4,000, the other side has to prepare for this contingency with highly negative effects on the mutual relationship. The second component is further actions in both countries needed to make these reductions effective, not only dismantling warheads, but also permanently closing down all production of fissile materials, closing all but one nuclear weapons plant in each country with its output to be verified by mutual inspection, a step-by-step close-down of nuclear testing, and placing all nuclear installations in both countries, civilian and military, under a combination of bilateral and multilateral IAEA controls. The steps like these are necessary because when you cut nuclear warheads to a low level, the dangers from concealed weapons goes way up. Cutting Soviet and United States nuclear weapons to a minimum level is not only the remedy for continuing risks from the Soviet Union, it's the necessary first step to trigger decisive moves towards effective controls over nuclear weapons throughout the world. So the third major component of this approach is to bring the other declared nuclear powers, the United Kingdom, France, and China, into the regime of agreed low limits on the basis of the deep United States-Soviet cuts, which each of these countries have cited as a precondition for accepting limits on their own forces. And we propose a limit of 500 to 700 warheads for each of these countries and closing down weapons production and testing on their part as well. We're urging prompt action to bring these countries into a system of international limits, not only for the sake of controlling their nuclear potential, but also in order to enlist their cooperation in establishing a non-proliferation regime with real teeth. This new regime would include renewal of the non-proliferation treaty with supplementary agreements mandating tougher IAEA inspection practices. But it also emphasizes a new action role for the United States, United Nations Security Council in controlling nuclear weapons, based on the beginnings that we've observed in the case of Iraq. One suggestion is that the Security Council undertake a commitment that it will act as the enforcement arm of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and that it will order inspections of any and all suspicious sites in member state territories and will follow up with joint actions of its own if suspicions continue. And second, to deter use of nuclear weapons by any state or by terrorist groups, we're urging that the five declared nuclear powers, the United States, Soviet Union, France, United Kingdom, and China, who are, as you know, the permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, commit themselves jointly to no first use of nuclear weapons. Gorbachev has proposed this action again, but as an independent measure, what I have in mind would make a decision far more operational. In my view, the five, after having committed themselves to no first use, should then join in a Security Council resolution making the threat of use of nuclear weapons or first use of weapons by states or groups an offense against world peace against which the Security Council would pledge itself to take joint action under the full range of possibilities in the UN Charter. And with this step, countries with nuclear weapons or terrorist groups which might gain control over them would know in advance that the Security Council would come after them with punitive action, what Saddam Hussein did not know when he invaded Kuwait. And there would be security assurances to non-nuclear countries which go far beyond those which the nuclear powers have extended thus far. A third proposed Security Council measure has to do directly with the undeclared nuclear powers. As a precondition for applying this measure, progress has to be made towards political settlement in the Mideast between India and Pakistan and between the two Korean states. That is to say, progress in dealing with the concerns which led some of these states to develop nuclear weapons. We assume that any Mideast settlement which is ultimately achieved will be guaranteed by the United States, Soviet Union, and other countries, giving Israel the promise of United States military support in the event of violation, which it has been seeking, but doing so in an even-handed way, also applying to the Arab states. Once political progress is achieved, we start from the premise that if the United States, other nuclear weapon states, and also the many non-nuclear signatory states of the Non-Proliferation Treaty are to undertake much more stringent obligations regarding nuclear weapons than the undeclared nuclear nuclear powers, too, must be brought under some form of international control. And to meet this need, we're proposing a Security Council decision at an appropriate stage to the effect that the failure of any state to accept minimum controls on its national nuclear installations within a specified period of time would be an unacceptable threat to international peace and security, and that the Council would act against the offending state with economic sanctions and other measures. The minimum controls that we have in mind under this measure would consist of a wide range of options for the three states now in this category of undeclared nuclear powers, including the signature of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, acceptance of bilateral or mutual multilateral inspection like that agreed between Brazil and Argentina, or participation in a verifiable nuclear weapons-free zone such as that proposed by Israel, Egypt, and other countries. To show that the Security Council is serious in its determination to act against those states which don't comply, we add a further rather controversial possibility. Like the other options I've described, this possibility would only be kept open for a specified grace period, perhaps 6 months. And under it, existing undeclared nuclear states would declare themselves as nuclear weapon states, while also accepting the full range of limitations already agreed to by the declared nuclear powers. including limits on the size of their forces, close down of fissile material production plants, a test ban, and international control of all of their nuclear facilities. In practical terms, we believe this could mean India in particular, and with it, Pakistan. According to these countries, nuclear status is not too much to pay to get control over their nuclear capability and also to permanently close off this route for other states. So to sum up, what we're trying to do here is to outline a comprehensive approach which can deal with problem number one, the huge continuing stockpile of Soviet and American nuclear weapons, an approach which can also cope with all aspects of nuclear weapons wherever they are found. It's also evident, I believe, that increasing cooperation of the five permanent members of the Security Council on controlling nuclear weapons will serve as a vehicle for promoting greater cooperation among them and other Security Council members in peacemaking and peacekeeping. I view nuclear arms control as a kind of locomotive or icebreaker leading towards establishment of a more effective international security system. For practical reasons, our approach is divided into two phases of implementation. In the first phase, the United States and the Soviet Union would reduce their strategic arms to a level of 3,000 to 4,000 warheads, destroy tactical range warheads, halt testing and production of fissile materials. The other declared nuclear powers would agree to no increased ceilings on their forces, halt production of fissile materials, and place all their nuclear facilities under international control. And in the second phase, the United States and the USSR would then move to a reserve nuclear force of between 1,000 and 2,000 warheads of all types. The other nuclear weapon states would accept specific limits on their nuclear warheads. All declared nuclear powers would accept the comprehensive test ban and move to the cooperative actions in the UN Security Council we have described. Now, still further down the road is ending production of plutonium and enriched uranium in civilian reactors throughout the world. The danger of diversion here is too high. Now, the division of these actions into phases is illustrative. They can't be achieved in a few months. Their full realization may take decades. But it is necessary to make a beginning and to articulate the long-term goals now and to set out toward them. This approach leads to questions about the long-term future of nuclear weapons as such. But we will not be able to give serious answers to this question until there is a functional world security system based on the United Nations. That will take some time. But in the meanwhile, we in the United States do not have to continue to live with a situation which has dominated our lives and Western policy for 30 years, the fact that in a half-an-hour surprise attack, the Soviet Union could obliterate our society and we theirs. Now, I remain skeptical about missile defense, which will compete with general purpose forces for scarcer funds and which can block the road to agreement on more effective non-proliferation measures. One important byproduct of the collapse of the Soviet Union, of the central Soviet structure in the aftermath of the anti-Gorbachev coup, is that it did eliminate the last vestiges of what up to now has been the strongest argument against missile defenses. That is, that testing or deploying them could lead to uncontrolled expansion of Soviet strategic missile forces. In its present state, the divided Soviet Union could not organize or finance such an effort. President Gorbachev has said yes to President Bush's suggestion for discussion of missile defense systems. This is not wholly unexpected in the light of the new situation in a much weakened Soviet Union, where the warning system, as I've mentioned, is dissolving along with the Union. But despite Gorbachev's agreement to discuss the matter, there are still strong arguments against even a thin nationwide missile defense system. Among them are that a combination of tough non-proliferation measures, control over sale of missile parts, and of flexible conventional forces to be used when needed is a more effective means of dealing with potential threats than missile defense. That is particularly true for the United States, where we are threatened not by long-range missile attack, but the possibility that nuclear weapons can be smuggled in as suitcase bombs or come into our ports in ships. Missile defense can do nothing about these risks. Of course, it's not in question that missile defense is expensive. $40 to $50 billion is the initial price tag of the system now under discussion. It will compete for scarce resources for conventional forces, which are more valuable for general defense and more effective for dealing with potential missile threats. And there's also a psychological factor. I think it's better for our country to remain engaged in the outside world than to move into isolation behind a shield of questionable effectiveness. Missile defense will downgrade the effectiveness of the nuclear forces of the other declared nuclear powers, Britain, France, and China, and the Soviet Union as well. Consequently, it will very probably be an obstacle, this is especially true of China, in gaining their cooperation to accept limits on their own nuclear forces, and what's equally necessary, to collaborate in a more active non-proliferation policy in the UN Security Council. Deployment of missile defenses, together with continued possession of large nuclear forces, would give the United States and Soviet Union a second tier, a second level of privileged status when compared to non-nuclear countries. And this circumstance could block efforts to extend and improve the non-proliferation treaty, which lapses in 1995. Well, I think I'll conclude these remarks so we can have plenty of time for discussion. The most important thing to keep in mind is that the present world situation is probably the most favorable since the emergence of nuclear weapons for a real breakthrough towards worldwide control. We should seize that opportunity now while it's still available. Thanks very much.
I would like to ask the first question. Professor Fernbach.
I'm struck with the utility of your 4 points and implementation stages. I wonder whether there isn't another point that might be put in there somewhere, perhaps as a sub-point somewhere, that is quite disturbing. The whole feature of clandestine activities in this field, particularly exporting parts, the way in which this is done, the inability of customs officials to know what they're looking at in terms of what is viable and what should be held back. Training in that field, a tremendous amount more should be done, and I think a great increase in the penalties of those who engage in this kind of activity. I'd find a devil's island somewhere for them, put them all up there and let them starve to death.
Yes, well, I share that view. There is an amazing array of controls now. Their effectiveness can well be disputed, but they're gathering steam. There's the missile control regime, there's the Nuclear Suppliers Club, there is the group of the five permanent members, which have now met twice to talk about exports of conventional weapons. There is a new regime on supercomputers, which are used to simulate nuclear testing so that you don't have to test perhaps at all. There are various subgroups, such as the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, thinking in the European Community, which have controls. All of them have proven full of holes, as you correctly state, particularly if we look at the case of Iran. and where, despite my fears and the fears of others about the new wave of Soviet expertise, which will be available for hard cash now, their training took place in our country and in Europe on the basis of a very long-term program which started with Saddam Hussein's predecessor. And that training in physics and nuclear physics can't really be stopped in that sense. But my feeling, my hope is that once you get a regime of the comprehensiveness of the kind that we're advocating, you can begin to make it a crime in the international crime in the eyes of the Security Council to actually cooperate on the secret construction of nuclear weapons. And then member states can invoke legislation against permitting people to work on these weapons. In Germany now, after the miserable record that they had with regard to the chemical weapons in Libya, also with regard to Iraq, they have imposed legislation which enables the German government to prosecute individuals, German citizens, for crimes committed outside of Germany in this sense, for assisting in the production of weapons of mass destruction. So I think that's a trail. Which will have to be repeated. It's my hope that if you can close down the weapons production plants and the control the sale of components far more vigorously. For example, up to now I cited the Soviet case of the Soviet Union, but exporters have not compelled the recipients of components to have full-scope safeguards, that is, to have the inspections of all of their plants in their country, not only the one that is being shipped out or going to be constructed. And this must be done beyond question. Also, there has not yet been a single special inspection under the IAEA regime, although it's in the charter, in the legislation setting up the IAEA. And this is in the hands of the Secretary General, Dr. Blix, who is a very effective man, but he hasn't felt in a position to order these inspections. One reason he hasn't felt in a position to do so is that he doesn't have any steady source of information on nuclear activities throughout the globe. He has only what individual countries report to him when they're setting up some new plant and accepting IAEA control, which then does not become universal in that country. And what he needs and what is going to be set up is a staff of small staff attached to him that can receive on a continuing basis information from member states. Now, and then, which will then direct his inspections. But the reason I suggested that the Security Council should take this on is that then it would no longer be in his hands and he would not have to balance sort of political considerations in his board of governors as to whether there should be such a special inspection. It would be automatic under the kind of system that I have in mind. What I have in mind is that the Security Council will, through its own resolutions, in effect, supplement the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which otherwise would have to be ratified by 140-odd members if you're going to try to change it. Right now, the prospects of the renewal of that treaty, which will lapse in 4 years, if not renewed, are somewhat in question. If it's renewed only for a five-year period, the legal experts say it will lapse after that five-year period without the possibility of further renewal. So it must be renewed indefinitely. Although we can see, and your question indicates, that there is need for tightening up the treaty itself, the fear is that efforts to open it up for amendment would cause a great deal of dispute, and that you might not even have the original treaty when you finished. The measures that I have suggested, that is, the end of the nuclear weapons production, the end of the phase out of testing, and so on, would, beyond any question, have an enormous positive effect on the non-nuclear signatory states, and I think they would assure the renewal of the treaty. But I don't think that they would assure the a broad amendment of the treaty in a positive sense. So what we have to do is get the renewal of the treaty, maybe have some supplementary understandings among the members that are not equivalent to a new treaty, and therefore perhaps easier to achieve, and then supplement it through Security Council resolutions. But also the other two measures I talked about, I think we really do have we obviously have to bring in the declared nuclear powers under some system of controls and the undeclared. Israel, of course, for us is the most difficult case. That's why I suggested that the action we propose should follow a political settlement rather than precede it.
Professor Lukic and Professor Duffield.
Yes, my question are related with the future of the START agreement and the CFE.
Yes.
In particular, START, and you mentioned that strategic nuclear weapons are deployed in Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and Belarus.
Yes.
My question is the following one. Do you think that President Gorbachev can enforce, can carry through the provisions of the START agreement? And second question is related, it's something which you did work for so many years on the CFE agreements. Do you think that the CFE agreements also can be carried through, particularly knowing how eager are the republics to establish the republican armies?
That's
we will have a lot of problems with ratification of this treaty by the Soviet Union and not by Senate in this country, because just an example of the Ukraine, which would like to create 450,000 conventional armies.
Right.
This is much, much bigger than, this is almost like French and the Bundeswehr together.
Right, right, quite so. Yes, well, that's a serious problem. The I mentioned that President Gorbachev committed himself to the United States government and to the other CFE governments to ratify both treaties in the present session of the Council of Republics. But he has not been able to get a quorum, what we would call a quorum, in there. Only 7 of the 12 republics have participated, Ukraine with observers. Ukraine, the High Council of the Ukraine has passed a resolution saying that it will abide by the START agreement. The hope is still that within the next month or so, the Council of the Republics will ratify. View, I think, in the State Department and other parts of the administration is that they will not look too closely as to the nature of that action, but will take it as legal and complete, and will then proceed with ratification here. It's my feeling that the central accountability that we're demanding of the administration and other countries are demanding of the Soviets will keep some central authority going in this field, although only with a very limited competence, perhaps for central military forces, which are going to be much reduced, and nuclear weapons, and a few other fields, perhaps international credit and certainly the UN seat, that the Security Council seat. And it's also my feeling that going ahead on a major program of the kind that I've mentioned, further deep cuts and seeking the cooperation of the central government as well as the republics in an effort to bring nuclear weapons under control elsewhere, will bolster the central authority in this regard. However, even if we do have a central authority as a result of this, and after the negotiation among the republics becomes more stabilized, it will be weak and unstable itself. And that's a major reason why I think that we should go far beyond the start levels in cutting back. CFE ratification is in a similar situation. The Senate has agreed, I believe, internally now to ratify CFE before Thanksgiving, subject to understandings with the administration that the administration will consult with the Senate if it has to make adjustments for the new republics and get the agreement of the Senate, whether formally or informally, to these changes. We are approaching, and the other CFE signatories, a few have ratified, by the way, Hungary, and I think Czechoslovakia, Poland, one or two of the others. All of the signatories are approaching this with the idea that the new republics will have to take on the same kind of limitations. Unfortunately, in the zonal arrangement, in a kind of concentric circle arrangement that you have in CFE, the biggest zone of storage is in the Ukraine, and if you take it literally, the Ukraine could have twice as many tanks as the Russian Republic. So more is going to have to be done to adjust that. Even if they accept the overall limitations, they're going to have to be some adjustment to limit the size. Everyone is worried about the Ukrainian forces. Few believe right now that they will actually get up to 450,000, as they said that they would. But Poland and Czechoslovakia are already highly concerned about the prospective size of these forces. And indeed, the virtue of the CFE treaty, if it is can be applied, is that it will regulate the military relationships between these countries. Otherwise, we can imagine to ourselves what it would mean if there is no CFE treaty and all of the armed forces in Europe, including the new states, are left free to increase and change as they would like. You would have an extremely unstable situation and one in which governments would spend most of their time worrying about what the other country is doing, and in which the possibility for positive cooperation would be very limited under circumstances of this kind. But you point to a real problem that people are thinking about and worrying about. I think that the Ukraine, which and the other Belarusia, Kazakhstan isn't involved in the CFE, but the other republics are. There's six or seven of the smaller ones, the Caucasian, Trans-Caucasian republics. They all realize that their agreement to apply these conditions and limits to themselves will be a precondition for recognition and for any kind of consistent help. So I think that we do, if the Western coalition stays together on this, and I think they will, I think they have very powerful leverage and they will be able to get something effective. It's not as though the republics were totally wild men, although a nationalist feeling has led to their independence from Russia in particular and from the center. They are aware of the outside world, and I think it will be possible to get some system of control, but one doesn't know. There's so many ethnic frictions. As you know, in the Russian Federation alone, there are 100 different nationalities, and we've already seen some explosions there and of what can happen. As I say, I consider the former Soviet Union as a sort of as the super Balkans with nuclear weapons, and there doesn't seem to be much prospect whatever that a central authority of even medium strength will survive in this situation. None of the experts from there, I've just talked to a group of them, or in the West, consider that this will be possible. They consider that the dissolution has, in practice, taken place.
Professor Duffield and Bill Bentwemple.
I have a question about the nuclear aspect of European security. It's really a two-part question. The first part is, how important will it continue to be to provide some kind of nuclear deterrence for Germany, even under the more favorable scenarios that you've sketched out with respect to what might happen in the Soviet Union, and then certainly in the case of a more unfavorable scenario where there are several nuclear armed republics, I suppose this would be an even greater concern, if only because of other countries' concerns about whether Germany itself might be tempted to acquire nuclear weapons without adequate extended deterrence. And the second part is, if that is a legitimate concern, even under favorable circumstances, what formal security arrangements would be most desirable and most feasible for providing deterrence to Germany? Will NATO continue to be the best way, or would an extended deterrence by France or Britain, or would even the creation of some kind of European nuclear force be most desirable and feasible?
Yes. In these very unsettled circumstances, with the possibility of four nuclear states in the Soviet Union, I think the continuation of some form of the United States nuclear presence in Europe is indicated and desirable. The president referred to it, he omitted deliberately to withdraw the air-mounted weapons. I take rather seriously the long-term possibility of German nuclear weapons if there is no other substitute. There is certainly no desire for that at the moment in Germany, to the contrary. But I think the United States should stay on in that role through NATO, and also should collaborate and help the British and French to move towards a position where they can provide some kind of European nuclear force in the very long run for the European community. Their own cooperation has been rather halting up to now. I don't think it would be a good situation if for the long run, if you had the European community without some armed forces of its own and without nuclear weapons, if there is to continue to be nuclear weapons at least the Russian Federation, possibly the others. I think that would be an unhealthy relationship. On the other hand, I think we all understand that having a European nuclear arrangement to which the non-nuclear states would have to have access in terms and input in terms of regulating its policy and size and nature, that comes at the end of the road of European integration. You have to achieve a situation where the Italian or the Spaniard has the same confidence in some central European structure as a French or British citizen has in their own government today, and that's manifestly far off, although not impossible after some decades. And that's one of the things that I think that the United States should be helping in. Now, unfortunately, it seems to me that although the president has recognized clearly the need to continue at this time, we don't have a long-term vision of the evolution of NATO, and we're still in a spat with the European community, with France in particular, concerning the development of the Western European Union, this very fragmentary military force that exists there, and which France wishes to build up in particular. The other European states have now come to the idea that in the long term the European community should have such a force, but they don't want to press ahead with the same vigor as the French. This is an unresolved problem, and it comes in good part from the fact that we're determined to keep NATO on at all costs because we see its benefits, and they are great, and they are seen by other Europeans now. And we don't want to contemplate, we're unwilling to contemplate the transition or what would need to move from a situation of NATO military capability through a gradual diminution of the American presence to a build-up of the European capability, which would seem the natural transition over a longer period. And it would happen best, surely, and in the most orderly way if a common goal and a common procedure were agreed on, rather than having this the center of bickering now, which to me can only result in weaker European forces and a weaker NATO.
Bill Wimple, and then George Barrow. Maybe that we'll finish with that.
I suppose that treaties, agreements, and so on would not be very effective against, if you imagine, a resurgent communist-type dictatorship arising and taking over through the Soviet former Union, which has been speculated as a possibility because of their economic disaster. And so I suppose that it would be a very important part of an agenda if we could figure out how to go about it, to see if there is a way to get them out of that, because we would not be dealing with a third world country and the Security Council, and so we'd be dealing with the former Soviet Union, armed to the teeth. I suppose that trying to find ways to get them out of that economic disaster they're in would be a very important objective for us.
And so, well, there is such danger as you or possibility as you describe of a resurgent authoritarian dictatorship. I would not say that the possibility of a communist one that was explicitly communist was very high, because I think that is discredited. The communist system is discredited.
Called something else.
Yes, but that would. I think the shorter term possibility is more. It's more likely that they will fight among themselves than that they will get together. The authoritarian trend, I think, is evident in each of the republics. Some, of course, have not. Still, do have old line communists without much change. It's unlikely, it seems to me, that although not impossible, that they will get together in a single block any longer. It is possible. Solzhenitsyn recommended it. You might remember that the Slavs, the Russians, and the Belarusians and the Ukrainians get together, might come together under the aegis of some compelling personality and intellectual system. That would take a considerable time before that could really get real roots. But yes, that's one reason why, psychologically at least, the cooperative approach that we talk of, I think, is desirable. At least it siphons off some of the psychological venom in the situation, that is to cooperate with the republics in the United Nations and in trying to make a general attack on controlling nuclear weapons. Yes, in the long run, the only safety is a stable system of economic capability that does seem to be many years, if not decades, off, and the unsettled conditions in the Soviet Union will probably last for decades and be a source of worry to all of us for that reason. There are still no political parties which could serve as the vehicles for an organized attack on the system. They're still backing and filling on the... Yeltsin has moved away from his resolution on the economic changes, and people are deadly afraid of really going into freeing prices and privatization on a broad scale. Moscow, I think, is relatively close. That's what Muscovites say to possible food riots and just general anarchy. And the picture that the most people have in their minds is of Russia in 1917 with all these armed bands of various kinds just going around the country pursuing their own aims. So, yes, it's a very bad situation, and it won't get better very soon.
Final question, George Barrow, and then Betty after that.
I read a paper some time ago, something that worries me, and I'm sure it worries a lot of people. Paul Niskey mentioned in his comments in the paper that in the agreements between the U.S. and Russia on the destruction of the all tactical nuclear warheads,
yeah.
What's going to happen to that plutonium? He says there's a 50-50 chance that plutonium and tritium will end up in unfriendly hands. What assurance do we have that that is not going to happen?
Well, I share the concern, and that's the reason why I suggested that there be some kind of verification or inspection of a mutual nature. We'd have to accept theirs in order to get ours there.
That'd be part of an agreement.
Yes.
100% verification that these things are going to happen.
Yes. As you know, the president's idea, and justified to move quickly, was to have these unilateral actions, but I don't think that's sufficient. And there will have to be a destruction program, and one worked out together. And I would like to see some mutual supervision, because it is extremely dangerous. Plutonium cannot be destroyed, and will have to be treated with the rest of the unresolved nuclear waste. But it can at least be controlled effectively. And that's why this whole system of controls has to come in into effect. Uranium can be degraded and used for civilian reactors, so that it's no longer dangerous. But all of a sudden, this proliferation danger, which was rather remote, and now is really coming up on us in a very dangerous way, and what the president has done, I think, is good, but really only the first step. I think mutual supervision must come as the next one.
The last question, Betty Smith.
You spoke earlier of the five nuclear powers having made a commitment, or willing to make, or should make a commitment for no first strike.
Yes.
And it seems to me that's a pretty bare bones kind of arrangement, because it's nothing more than a pious hope that they won't. And I wondered if there's any way to reassure us that that could be the case if we began to distinguish, and there were a practical way to do it, between first and second strike weapons, nuclear weapons. There's some talk, it even came up the other day, Mr. Bush brought it up when he defended his maintaining ballistic weapons on submarines.
Yes.
Because he claimed they were second strike.
Yes.
Well, now, I don't quite understand that, but it could be so. But in any case, would that be a feasible distinction that we could make? And working on the basis of that,
Yes, well, I see your point. No first use pledge that we had in mind would follow the acceptance of controls, including international inspection, on all of the nuclear powers. So they would have shown through their actions that they were fairly sincere on the subject. Also, I think that their pledge to act together in the Security Council against offenders would be strongly motivated, because they wouldn't want anyone else, since they'd accepted these stiff restrictions, to just get away with use of nuclear weapons. Even so, I think that they could. There would be some you could depend to a considerable degree on common action. However, it is possible the system might break down, particularly with regard to China, which is the odd man out in this group up to now. In that case, the four remaining ones could still act together to take action against the offender. More generally, that's what we're trying to achieve, a situation where you would be compelled to have only second strike. If you reduce... If you have at your disposal 10,000 warheads, or even four, which you would have in under Gorbachev's START-2 proposal, you still can wipe out the other side with a surprise attack, regardless of the intention. You have the capability. The other side has to act as though you had this. It has to remain keep most of its forces on alert. Even though the president has taken some, has brought some to stand down, the possibility of accidental launch and inadvertent nuclear war is quite high under those circumstances. So what we want to do is bring down the level of warheads by the major powers to such a low level that even if they did carry out a surprise attack, they could not do devastating damage either to the other country or to their nuclear forces. And they both would be compelled, therefore they would not have surprise attack capability, both would be compelled to, if a crisis came, to wait and see if an attack took place and then to respond presumably against military targets. If you have 1,000 warhead force, one third will be destroyed in such a surprise attack, another third will not function, and you'll get about 300 on target. That will create a catastrophic damage, even if restricted to military targets, but it won't wipe out the entire civilization as 4,000 would. So that's the sense of our proposal exercise in rather gruesome detail.
Thank all of you, and we thank Ambassador Dean for a most comprehensive discussion. Thank you very much.